There's a lot of things in this old world that just do not make sense. Like why there's so few believers on the firing line, while so many others sit the fence. But if you want to know where the Word of God stands, and believe it wants to use your feet and hands, it's time to take your faith out of the seats and into the streets, and come along with me. If you'll only look, then you will see on WCN TV.
Welcome to today's WCN-TV program. We're broadcasting live, and it's Tuesday, June 9th, 2026. Welcome also to all the folks that are joining us live here in the studio audience. I think some more will be coming shortly. You know, I'd like to start today by reading from the first chapter of the first book of the Bible, Genesis 1, 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. God did not make a mistake when he created two separate and distinct sexes. He created two distinct sexes, male and female, in every creature. Even plants have male and female counterparts. That was God's purposeful design. In human beings, the roles of men and women complement one another. And because of the respective physiology, like all male and female living things, we're able to reproduce. We're able to be fruitful and multiply naturally as God designed. It doesn't work any other way. God's natural design for males and females is also the natural foundation for marriage and family. The natural family is the basis for sane, properly functioning communities, and children need the influence and guidance that both a mother and father can provide. Countless studies show that when children grow up lacking one parent, they struggle and suffer. Studies also show that when two men or two women attempt to raise children together, those children grow up with a great many mental, psychological, spiritual, and social problems. So as hard as we humans try to assume we know better than our Creator, and we can reframe the definitions of male, female, marriage, family, and even love, we can never improve upon the natural design and purpose of God's creation. But we certainly can cause a lot of confusion and delusion in our attempts to do so. Now, everyone knows there are two distinct and necessary sexes, male and female. But there are now at least 72 different genders that have been officially recognized and affirmed. 72. We need to make a distinction here between biological sex and gender. The concept of gender roles was first introduced by a guy named John Money in 1955. He was a psychologist and sexologist at Johns Hopkins University, and he reframed masculinity and femininity as learned cultural patterns rather than natural traits. I'm not going to go into all the details of his so-called work, but suffice to say, it was perverse and for some deadly. For centuries, homosexuality was considered a mental disorder. God considers it an abomination. And for centuries, people confused about their own sexuality were also considered to have a mental disorder. But with the onset of the LGBTQ plus movement, things began to change. In the 70s, we knew of transvestites, those who enjoyed dressing up in opposite sex clothing, but this was rare. In recent years, a whole new industry has emerged, pridefully catering to the sexually confused. Today, transgenderism has gone mainstream, and the idea of an infinite number of possible genders has been especially intriguing to young, impressionable children who are just trying to fit in with their peers. The trouble is, these kids are now being groomed by pedophiles, and LGBTQ+ doctrines are being used in public schools as sex education curriculum. Confused children are being further indoctrinated by popular TV programming for kids, social media, pop culture at large, and particularly concerning, in some cases, even their own parents. This has led to children being prescribed wrong sex hormones and children having their sex organs surgically removed, rendering them not only mutilated and sterile for life, but even more psychologically scarred, deeply confused, and depressed. All right, so I know that all of you, most of you probably know all this information already, but our guest today is going to shed some more light on all this as we get into our discussion. Our guest is Dr. Melanie Kreitzbacher. She's a urological pelvic reconstructive surgeon from, of all places, Portland. I'm sure they have a lot of need for this out there. She's uniquely qualified to speak on this subject, and she has chosen not to perform so-called gender reassignment surgeries. She's a devout Christian and believes that children are a gift from God and made in His image. Dr. Melanie, welcome to the program. Hi. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
So why don't we start out, how prevalent is true gender dysphoria? We hear that word a lot, but how prevalent is it when it's actually a thing?
Yeah, so gender dysphoria, now we've got exponentially an exponential increase actually since 2015 when social media hit its peak, essentially. And, you know, it was steadily climbing until about 2023. And then it started decreasing again among students. But if we want to separate, for instance, gender dysphoria, which the definition of that is an incongruence in the way you feel between that and your biological sex. So when you have an incongruence between the two, so basically what you are biologically and how you feel, that's called gender dysphoria. But what I will say that is oftentimes it's used interchangeably by the activist community is the term intersex. And intersex is actually 0.018% of the population. And some studies will include conditions like congenital adrenal hyperplasia or chromosomal abnormalities that where individuals will have, XXY chromosomes or XYY, sorts of things like that, aberrant chromosomes and congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is, a condition basically of hormone insensitivity. And even if you count the population, of individuals that have those conditions, it's still only 1.7% of the population. So less than 2% of the population for true intersex state, which is having both male and female, sex characteristics.
So when you say intersex, you're basically referring to like a birth defect.
That's correct. It is a true pathological diagnosis. Everything else is ideologically based.
Okay. All right. Well, I did try to find some statistics on all this, but I'm afraid the most recent figures I could find basically go back 2016 to 2020. But according to that research, during those 5 years, there were more than 48,000 patients who underwent gender reassignment surgery. Mm. And to give you an idea of how quickly this movement is rising, in 2016, there are about 4,000 of those surgeries. 5 years later, that number rose to over 13,000.
Right.
And overall, 8% of those were under 18 years old.
Correct. Yes. So from actually, we don't have the newest numbers just yet, but from 2019 to 2023, individuals under the age of 18, I believe it was 14 to 15,000 children underwent some form of mutilation, whether it is, and they give them cutesy terms, top surgery, bottom surgery, let's call it what it is, mastectomies and chopping off genitals. You know, not the cutesy terms. You know, it's so, yeah, that's, you know, we're waiting for the new, you know, the new numbers to come out, but that was from 2019 to 2023. And it was $120 million industry at that point in time, which I'm fairly certain is lower than the actual number because of all of the medical fraud that has gone on, as far as fraudulent billing, because you have to have a diagnosis code for insurance to pay for, particular diagnoses. So these were obtained only from the information that could be obtained from true medical records actually accurately reflecting what is going on. So if somebody was listed as having an endocrine disorder and was given testosterone, for instance, that would never be flagged as transgender care because it was actually fraudulently diagnosed, which is how a lot of these institutions got away with and have gotten away with treating minors, because they code it as something different so that they can, you know, proceed with this so-called gender affirming care.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because when I was doing my research and finding the numbers I just gave you, that came from healthcare insurance numbers. Mm-hmm. How does this work? My insurance covers almost nothing. I don't even know why we have it unless I'm, you know, but anyway, I have some more numbers here. Between 2017 and 2021, approximately 300,000 minors, and these are ages 6 to 17, identified as transgender, and about 15,000 of them started cross-sex hormone treatments. First of all, how can a 6-year-old identify as transgender? When I was 6, I was still trying to figure out how to tie my shoes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they don't. You know, it is learned behavior, and that truly is a except in exceptionally rare instances, which was still less than 0.5% of the population of individuals who truly, truly believed that they were born in the wrong body. No child thinks that they were born in the wrong body. You know, just like no child has any bias towards race. You know, most kids, I mean, you put them all together and they play in peace. They don't care if you're black, purple, green, brown. It doesn't matter. You know, kids are kids, and they innately know the truth. So no kid, you know, at 6 years old is saying, oh, I need to be a girl. In fact, and I use myself as an example, you know, I was a child, you know, of the 70s and early 80s, and I was raised on a farm. All of my parents' friends, they all had boys. And so I was the only girl on the farm with all the boys. And my 8-year-old self said, you know what? I just want to be a boy. But what my head was thinking that my mouth could not articulate is not that I wanted to be a boy. I just didn't want to be treated any differently. I wanted to be able to do the things on the farm that the boys did. But had I been in today's society, and some school counselor or some creepy adult had heard me, they would have tried to whisk me away and tell me, oh yes, you were absolutely born in the wrong body. You know, you need to, you know, start identifying socially as a boy and start going down this road.
If it's okay with you, Dr. Melanie, I'd like to bring in one of our people in the audience here, mm-hmm. Who I think you will find very intriguing also. David, are you willing to tell your story?
Sure. So, I mean, I can say, because, you know, right now there's like this meme going around social media that says, how many of you have ever known a gender dysphoric child in the 1970s and 80s? And I was a gender dysphoric child in the 1970s and 80s. But what a lot of people don't really recognize is that it's a trauma response. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was dissociative disorder, right? Which we now just call it gender dysphoria. When it happens to a boy who wants to be a girl or a girl wants to be a boy, but it's a trauma response. And so I was abused as a young child by my trusted adults, teachers, friend's father, so on and so on, family friend. So I dissociated from self. I became very gender dysphoric, wanting to be a girl. We didn't have any of the influence then. I mean, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, you didn't even know what a trans was. You didn't know what a drag queen was. You know, you thought it was weird when you saw a man or the bearded woman or something like that. But growing up into it, I just know those moments when I just felt like God made a mistake. I was born in the wrong body. And that's with no influence at all. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of other people that were falling into those categories too, were abused or trafficked. And they too suffered dissociative disorders or dependency disorders. But I think that a lot of it is like when we talk about intersex, right? I think one thing that always needs to be said, and I learned this from Dr. Michelle Cortella, actually, years ago, that never in history has anyone been born with a complete functioning male and female sex organ. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, in, you know, the people out there need to understand that. It's not like there's this huge, super low percentage of people who are born male and female, because that's not what it is. It's just a birth defect. But gender affirming care, as far as your numbers go, Rob, gender affirming care sanctuary states, they're still providing gender affirming care procedures and surgeries to children and of no age right now. So you're getting, so anywhere from 4 and up can be placed on puberty blockers. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are poisons, right? These were experimental drugs, that were first used to chemically castrate, violent sexual offenders. Correct. And then they tried to use them for cancer. I mean, so these are like the things that they're giving children. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sorry, I get caught up in the statistics and everything, because we're always looking for statistics and numbers and polls, and they're all biased. Mm-hmm. They say that detransitioners are low, that they're rare, and that's not true. I know of hundreds and hundreds of them, but there are thousands of them out there, and they're marked as being rare because these trans clinics are keeping them marked as happily transitioned. Even the ones who have committed suicide and ended their lives, they're mm-hmm. still marked down as happily transitioned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so these are some of the things that I think really need to be brought to the table. We had four years ago, there was a 4,000% increase mm-hmm. in young girls identifying as trans. Mm-hmm. And I saw right here where I live at in Maine, when a teacher reached out to me in 2015, there was a 4% population in the high school that identified into the LGBTQ movement. And by 2018, it was 56% identifying. Mm-hmm. Cool. And it's that social contagion, right? And mm-hmm. so I was on wrong sex hormones at 14 years old. I was also a runaway on the streets of Philadelphia, and I was also, you know, in and out of glitter families or trafficking homes. My wrong sex hormones were given to me at first, and then I was just buying them on the streets. They were all black market. By age 20, I was sterile. By age 25, I had osteopenia. By age 30, I had osteoporosis, heart disease, and thyroid issues, all directly related to the wrong sex hormones. And, you know, so I spent 20 years as a trans-identified, quote-unquote, woman. It's absurd to say I feel like a woman, and that's absurd because having never been an actual woman, how could you possibly know what one feels like or what it feels like to be one, right? Mm-hmm. But and so that's my story, and I just thought I'd throw it out there. I just, there's, I may, ha, I'm probably going to have some questions for you by the end of the show. So I don't want to interrupt. Thank you, Rob, for bringing me in and giving me a moment to just explain to myself, because I'm always in the chat. And I just wanted you to know, like, I'm not trying to debate you or anything. I'm just putting my two cents in everywhere I possibly can, because I think it's important that everybody gets a complete understanding from both sides.
That is correct. And, you know, and that was going, you know, that's generally what I segue into when I start talking about the studies. You know, 58% of individuals who identify as something other than male or female, 58% of those individuals have an actual, at least one, psychological disorder. And the majority of those individuals, actually up to 75% of those, actually have three. And what we also know is that these same individuals, as you quite rightly said, because I also, you know, work in, you know, the child trafficking space as well, and how transgender ideology feeds into child trafficking. So I'm pretty well versed on that as well. That, you know, these sorts of individuals that are struggling with this ideology, it is a trauma response. It is either mental or physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, in some form or fashion, a PTSD, and or on the autism spectrum, or have some other neurodivergent diagnosis. So these are the most vulnerable individuals. And you are again also correct with the statistics about individuals who are considered detransitioners. Those numbers are grossly, grossly underreported, because first of all, a number of these individuals have been lost to follow up, so they are not reported. The other issue is that, you know, just like the organization that I work with, Resilience Health Network, to try to set up a framework and a network where detransitioners can find care. The problem is the healthcare community, it's all experimental medicine. So when individuals they're more than happy, healthcare providers are more than happy to provide these very powerful medications with no protocol, no parameters, no dosing parameters, nothing. They're more than happy to take individuals down that road, but it's not an exact science. It doesn't have any protocol, and healthcare providers then ghost these individuals when they want to transition back to some semblance of biological reality. So you can't quantify accurately the individuals that are considered detransitioners because you can't find care for them. So, you know, and even as a healthcare provider myself, I'm quote unquote in the know. I can't find colleagues that will help to take care of these individuals. And I have quite a lot to say about the detransitioner clinic that's being set up in Texas. And I just saw today that Cleveland Clinic has jumped on the bandwagon. I've got quite a lot to say about that, those sorts of things. Everybody's doing the Snoopy dance and saying, you know, it's a step in the right direction. Well, yes, it is. But I don't believe that it has been thoroughly thought out. And you know, it's again, virtue signaling, that is going to end very badly unless they get people in there that know how to run such clinic. Going back to the puberty blockers are used in true conditions of pathological diagnosis called precocious puberty. And all that is for a span of time. For when the individual, precocious puberty is when an individual starts developing sexually and going through puberty far earlier than they should. Again, that's a pathological diagnosis. Puberty blockers are given just long enough for those individuals' bodies to grow enough to catch up with being ready to handle the barrage of hormones that are going to happen with natural puberty. The problem is, those are the studies that are being quoted. And that is, again, a very small subset of individuals. Puberty blockers are actually the same medications that I give to men with prostate cancer. And you're putting those of drugs into little bodies that without any sort of guidance or parameters. So again, I say that it is absolute admission by the medical community that nobody knows what in the world that they're doing, because if they did, they would not be ghosting detransitioners, because they would know what to do with the individuals. It's because there was no protocol to begin with, and there certainly is no protocol to take these individuals to backtrack to some semblance of normalcy. So in my estimation, that is a gross admission by the medical community. They didn't know what they were doing to begin with.
Let me throw open a can of worms here. So you're in the medical community, and I'm not condemning everyone in the medical community, although I do not trust them anymore like I used to prior to 2020. Are the hospitals or doctors incentivized financially in some way to prescribe these things, to push the parents and the kids into the wrong sex hormones, the puberty blockers, the drugs, and then ultimately the surgery?
Well, in a roundabout way, they can be. To my knowledge, it is not direct incentivizing, by the academic institutions, but it is an incredibly lucrative business. Now, where you start getting into following the money is, again, yes, it is a very lucrative business. So, when you put an individual on, hormones, whether it's puberty blockers, whether it is cross-sex hormones, you've got a patient for life. I mean, that's just the way it is. There's no getting around that. Once you start manipulating hormones, you've got a patient for life. And hormonal manipulation in and of itself can be anywhere from $25,000 to $50,000, a year for these individuals. Now, where it starts getting dicey is that, of course, it brings in money to the academic institutions. And in fact, Matt Walsh did a segment on Vanderbilt University where the head of the gender clinic there was touting, how much money that, that they are actually bringing in. But let me take it a step further. You've got private individuals, private doctors who are partners in surgery centers. And surgery centers generally... those surgery centers generally have a hospital partner that is, for instance, like a 51% shareholder, and the rest of the shares are divvied up among surgeons. So if you think about it, you get a urologist, you get an anesthesiologist, you get a plastic surgeon, you get a gynecologist, all partners of a surgery center, and a lot of these procedures can be done in a surgery center. So not only is the surgery center getting a facility fee for doing these procedures, but then each individual doctor is billing for their individual piece of it, just like in a hospital. If you have a surgery, you get a bill, and one bill is from the hospital, and then one bill is from the anesthesiologist, and one bill is from the surgeon. Same thing happens with the surgery center. But what then ends up happening is all of the partners of the surgery center get a quarterly payout of anything above and beyond overhead. Once the surgery center pays their overhead expenses, anything above and beyond is then divvied up to the partners on a quarterly basis. So if you're a partner in a surgery center, you can see where this would be very lucrative. So it's all well and good that, the federal government has said, hey, we're cutting off finances for, hospital systems who are providing these services. But what in fact is going to happen in my estimation, and this is purely my opinion, but just knowing how the system works, is it's going to be, this is all this is a game of whack-a-mole, because you can shut it down with the hospitals. You're not going to stop them, you know, at the private, in the private sector of the surgery centers, and if the hospitals are partners of the surgery centers. So all they're going to do is they're going to move those procedures from the hospital to the surgery centers, and they'll charge insurance for it. So Medicare, Medicaid, they'll charge them for it under the auspices of the private surgery centers.
Very similar to what they did with abortion.
Correct.
So, do you think these doctors that are doing these procedures are doing them in good conscience? Do they believe in what they're doing?
I think some of them do. I think some of them have wholeheartedly drunk the Kool-Aid. But in my opinion, it is very multifactorial, because you have individuals that truly think that they are doing the right thing and they are not using any common sense whatsoever. And then you have doctors, and we've seen it throughout time, that are just flat out greedy, and they are unethical, and they are going to jump on the bandwagon of what the highest paying thing is at the time. And unfortunately, that is just the nature of the beast. I can't say that it is one thing or another. It is multi-layered, multifaceted, multifactorial. I truly just do not understand how these doctors are making a case for this. In fact, it's interesting, David, that you had this experience in Philadelphia, because I went up against the doctor who started the program in Philadelphia, and I called him out in a meeting, a surgical meeting 2 years ago that I was in, where he was talking about all of this being unicorns and rainbows, and everybody is so happy with their outcomes and all this and that. And this individual was a plastic surgeon and was showing all of the photos on the PowerPoint of how wonderful this is, did not talk about any surgical complications, did not talk about the irreversible harm that, you know, that this causes, and was not giving any references for the statistics that he was presenting. And during the Q&A session, I stood up and I said, you know, you're showing all of these wonderful outcomes and all of these individuals who supposedly have not had any complications. You're quoting all of these statistics, but you have no references. And he says, well, you can go to such and such journal and find it here and there. And I said, yes. I said, I'm a pelvic reconstructive surgeon. I am familiar with those, with those journals, and it's not there. I then called him out on the fact that he said that puberty blockers were completely irreversible. Of course, there was no answer back on that. And then when I went back and looked up a statement that he had made and was quoted as saying in an article done by a news outlet in Philadelphia, he said that he did not perform the urethral reconstructive procedures because of the level of complications, because there were significant complications. So, okay, complete and utter contradiction there. And this is what I'm fighting, because this is a plastic surgeon. I'm a urologist. I know how to reconstruct the plumbing. That's my fellowship training. That was direct admission by this man that it was not all sunshine and roses. I have a big problem with the misrepresentation of a lot of my colleagues.
Okay. David has a comment.
So in Philadelphia, what I noticed between Philadelphia and New York City is, growing up into it, everyone was getting free-floating silicone injected into their face and their body, but no doctors were doing it. It was just done by somebody in their home. Like the person who put it in my face and my body was one of my best friends, right? Mm-hmm. I called him my gay mama, actually. I mean, he was a trans that, you know, just he got addicted to silicone is what he got addicted to, and mm-hmm. addicted to changing his image constantly and morphing. But so there was a doctor who was prescribing, or not really prescribing, but giving us hormones, mm-hmm. For favors, for sexual favors. And he was doing it out of his basement because he had lost his license, but he was also doing castrations and other little things in his basement. And so there were so many things, so many different things happening, that there was another doctor who was probably the first actual real doctor that handed me hormones, wrong sex hormones. And that doctor, I remember saying to me that, because everybody was running around Philadelphia and New York City with these high cheekbones, these long chins, these extravagant bodies, like, you know, hips, everything, because of all this free floating silicone and implants. And so the doctor said to me, this is going to be a really good business. So we will be starting to do the free floating silicone. We will start to do these implants. We will start to do this because this is a very good business. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty much what I saw that they saw. They saw a really good business because all of these victims, right? All of these broken, depressed, delusional people that have been victimized throughout their entire lives, and we're still being victimized just by the system now, were addicted to silicone and hormones. And it was also around the same time that my first hormones were free. And so they were also giving out testosterone in the lesbian clubs. And so I believe these to be big pharma reps that were going around and giving them out for free. And then the drug dealers in the club were getting all the free hormones and then selling them. And that's why how I was buying them. But I think that it was just all part of this big plan to create exactly what we've seen the last, 16, 15 years.
Mm-hmm. And I would not be a bit surprised. I have some horror stories of having been on call in Portland, Oregon, when I was living there and in private practice and was on call for the hospitals. I've got some horror stories of some exact similar things, except one of the most horrific things that I experienced was mutilation by a former veterinarian from California who had lost his license and would come up, as I found out, would come up to Portland and go to these underground parties in Portland and would bring his instruments and would castrate individuals and perform other surgeries during these parties. And I had the unfortunate experience of having to take care of some of these individuals because they had to come into the emergency room for various different complications and emergencies.
Wow. Can I just really quick, I'll tell you one of the things that stopped me from going any further. I went to New York City to get castrated, and for probably about 10 years, I had known from the time I was 14 till the time I was about 24, 25, I had known these two post-operative transgenders. And I thought, like, I idolized them. I wanted to be them. They were beautiful. They looked like women. They were always happy. They just looked like they had it all together. They're very secure, content, you know. And when I went to New York to get castrated, they lived in New York. So I was hanging out with them. And I was sitting on a beach on Coney Island, and one of them looked at me and said, "Don't do it." Mm-hmm. And I looked at him and he said, "All my life, I felt like if I could just become a woman, I would find peace and joy and happiness." He said, "Now I'm legally and medically a woman, and I'm more miserable now than I had ever been." And I think about taking my life every day. And the other one said, you don't want to be us. Every day I get on the subway several times a day. And every single time the train comes down the track, I think of stepping in front of it. You don't want to be us. And so I went back to my hotel and just like, I just remember like releasing, letting it all out. Because, you know, I was the suicidal trans kid that they're always trying to toss into these, you know, debates and arguments to promote this cult. But what they don't tell you is that they turn into suicidal trans adults. And I was kept being told by the movement itself, just keep transitioning and it'll go away. It'll go away. When you reach your goal, it'll go away. And now here's two that just reached their goal and they told me it does not go away, you know? And so I didn't go any further. I did remain trans identified for many more years and just took wrong sex hormones, but I didn't have any more procedures done, no more silicone put in my body. But, you know, it was that woke me up. And it's that I wish that more parents and more of these victims would hear about and embrace more.
And that's very consistent with the studies that were just released the second week of April, actually. It was a follow-up study out of Finland by Ruska. Showing that individuals, that trans identifying individuals, in fact, don't have better mental health, if they transition. In fact, it can worsen and have significant complications, as a result. So that is confirmed with the study that just came out 2 months ago.
Let's back things up here and talk about the kids again. Dr. Melanie, what role are you seeing the parents playing in this crazy rise in confused kids about their gender and at such a young age? And are parents also being emotionally manipulated to support this?
They are. And again, that is a multifactorial problem as well. And I have a theory, about one of the causes. But some parents are just absolutely caught off guard with this rapid onset gender dysphoria. Their kid comes home and says, I'm trans. Some parents are just completely caught off guard. And then when they take their child, to the doctor or to the therapist, they're being told, well, would you rather have a live son or a dead daughter sort of thing? Which is complete and utter, medical and emotional manipulation, emotional blackmail. And of course, parents think that, the providers, know what's best. So that's one aspect. Some parents just frankly don't have a clue themselves, and they've drunk the Kool-Aid hook, line, and sinker. They think that and truly believe that they're doing the right thing for their children. But the theory that I have about a lot of these individuals as well is that it is generational trauma, and that these parents themselves have unresolved issues. And rather than, going through a healing process, or maybe if they have, sought out therapy or something like that, that it's unresolved, and they think that they are going to give their children what they didn't have. And so by affirming their children that, they are giving their children the life that they never had and the acceptance that they never had, much like, parents that, are poor and they sacrifice everything so that their kids can go to an Ivy League school. Same sort of thing, this generational trauma, and that it is now perpetuated. So a form of Munchausen's by proxy, which we are seeing. And a lot of it also, in my opinion, is just flat out political virtue signaling and having no regard for the mental health of the children. And the fact of the matter is, unless individuals find their healing through Christ, they're not going to find healing at all. And so that would be my witness. And that is the witness of a number of individuals that we have filmed. My team and I at Remnant Films are making a documentary, and this is what we are finding out from all of the individuals that we have interviewed, is their only healing came through Christ. They tried everything else and they just found no fulfillment.
Same with every sin we struggle with, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. So these children taking these drugs and hormones and whatnot, what are the adverse effects, and can the damage that they do be reversed?
No, damage can't be reversed. I will answer that question right now. Once you go so far down the road, you can't reverse it. Now, if you're on hormones, say for 2 months, 3 months, then, you know, okay, fine. There's some hope there. You know, there are a lot of things that haven't done permanent damage, but much like David mentioned, these individuals will have a higher incidence of cardiac issues, osteoporosis, joint pain and discomfort, predisposition to particular cancers, migraines, tumors. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And the longer that you are on these hormones, the more irreversible they become. You know, even if you go back to your native hormones that, you know, for your biological sex, you've already influenced your body and the tissues in your body to the point that there is no return. So think about, for instance, one of the very easy things to think about is subjecting a female to high doses of testosterone and the deepening of the voice. You can't get that back. That's not something that you can recover from. And in fact, there's a pretty prominent detransitioner, Kat Kattinson, and she actually was, her testimony is that she was a singer and performer and she lost her voice. She can't, you know, and she couldn't sing after the influence of the high doses of testosterone. And that's kind of the most easy thing to think about when you think about irreversible harms. It goes far deeper than that to the other things that I mentioned, as well as a whole host, you know, of other issues as well.
Well, it's got to mess with a person's mind, in unspeakable ways.
Correct.
You know, not just physiological, but mentally.
Every detransitioner that I have spoken with and worked with have said it exactly like this. The hormones made me crazy. I had underlying mental health issues to begin with, but the hormones just made me crazy. And then I started talking to, you know, another individual who said, you know, kind of tongue in cheek and making a joke about it, but not really either. Said, if you don't believe that hormones are powerful, just talk to a pubescent boy or a postmenopausal woman, and you'll find out just exactly how important hormones are and how powerful they are. So, you know, it was making a joke, but then again, you know, not really. And, you know, being a woman of a certain age myself, I can tell you when hormones start declining, there's a difference.
Yeah. And when we're talking about kids, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, 11 years old, it doesn't matter. It's child abuse of the worst possible degree.
Absolutely.
Anyone else in our studio audience, any questions or comments? We have about 10 minutes left here. So now is your chance. Might not get another one. Talk to Dr. Melanie. All right. So, since 2024, what I discovered in my notes today was that 15% of the hospitals and medical facilities have either ended or restricted youth gender change treatments. Not necessarily have they stopped for adults, but they 15% fewer are working with youth. And I think a part of that is due to lawsuits, isn't it? Mm-hmm. A jury just awarded a detransitioner $2 million in a medical malpractice suit in February. And a psychiatrist reportedly agreed to settle another detransitioner's medical malpractice claim just this past January. So, when they come to their senses, they're not happy, are they?
No. No, and neither are the practitioners, because in the Foxvarian case in New York, that case was the plastic surgeon and the mental health professional. And Camille Kiefel, that just had her case settled in Oregon with the mental health practitioner, that was the mental health practitioner, which, don't even get me started on Oregon. I had to leave Oregon for a reason. we'll just leave it at that. It had just become such a hostile environment, and just politically unstable.
I visited there once. I couldn't get out fast enough. So,
Oregon itself is absolutely beautiful.
Yes, it is. Yes.
It is absolutely beautiful. And the majority of the individuals there are not of the political persuasion that Oregon reflects, because Oregon is ruled by Portland, Eugene, and Salem. And that's just the fact of the matter. But because of that, somebody like me cannot stay in Oregon. It's unfortunate. I had a very, very good practice, until COVID, and COVID is actually what forced me out. And then I started speaking out about this, but going back to the cases, what is happening is within 48 hours of the Foxvarian case is when, the American Association of Plastic Surgeons issued their statement saying, oh yes, the science is not settled. This is experimental medicine. And then American Medical Association followed suit. And the problem is, what's happening is the only thing that changed was the medical malpractice cases being settled and now setting precedent. So they know, these societies know that they're next, because the societies are the ones that set the guidelines for the physicians. So when a patient comes in and wants a particular procedure, or you're going to, perform surgery, like me as a urologist, I will say, okay, according to AUA, American Urological Association guidelines, this is what the guidelines say. So the organizations are the ones setting the guidelines. So what is happening is, on the heels of those cases, then the societies are now backtracking and say, whoa, no, sorry, we got it wrong. Really? Because the only thing that changed in 48 hours was that somebody got sued, and won. The problem is now is that the providers are now blaming the mental health practitioners. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it's essentially,
is it going to continue? Is it going to go right back down to the kindergarten teacher that started the whole thing?
Yes. I mean, somebody's going to blame somebody else who's going to blame somebody else. And the fact of the matter is, okay, you know what? If the school system fails, you're probably not going down an irreversible path. You can reverse social transition. Okay. If the mental health field fails, okay, you still may not, you're still not down an irreversible road. If the medical system fails, you're hosed, because at that point in time, it is up to the medical practitioners to be the gatekeepers, to use your common sense, to use your medical training, to do no harm. Mm-hmm. We are the gatekeepers. So for a surgeon to say, oh, well, I got the letter from the mental health practitioner, well, the mental health practitioner isn't the one operating on the patient. You are. So really, you're going to blame the mental health practitioner because you're saying you can't think for yourself as a surgeon to assess the mental health of a patient? Just ask any reasonable plastic surgeon that does breast augmentation and rhinoplasties and all of the cosmetic procedures. They will not touch somebody who has any semblance of mental instability. That is career suicide, because you know you are never going to meet that patient's expectations because the expectations are so distorted. And I say that reasonable practitioners.
Right.
You know that. And as a doctor, you know, because you have seen that person, ideally, you've seen that person multiple times. You've followed them. You know and can get a sense what their mental health is. So don't tell me that you are going to blame the mental health practitioner who, frankly, probably only saw the patient for 30 minutes, if that, on a Zoom link.
Right, right.
So the medical community, we are the gatekeepers. And if the medical community fails, then it's irreversible. So yeah, I just have a big problem with my colleagues out there who are passing the buck and there is no accountability.
Okay. We're down to about 3 minutes. You mentioned earlier Texas. So Texas Children's Hospital announced last month that it's going to be closing its gender clinic and opening its first detransition clinic.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, as I said before, it's going to fail miserably. I don't believe that they have thoroughly thought it out, because as a provider who is, you know, one of the initial organizers of Resilience Health Network to set up care for detransitioners, and we can't find colleagues to take care of these individuals, who is Texas Children's going to get to take care of these individuals? The same people that medically transitioned them, because they didn't know what they were doing either. And there's no protocol to care for these patients and backtrack it. So the few of us that do feel comfortable are the ones that should be involved, not putting the same people that did the harm and forcing them to take care of the individuals. Because if you're forcing these individuals to provide care to begin with, it is going to be subpar care, and they're not going to know what they're doing to begin with because they didn't know what they were doing to start with. So unless it is thoroughly thought out, which would take, you know, a couple of years at best, all this is virtue signaling and saying, hey, look at us, we're doing the right thing. And I hate to say that, because a lot of people are doing the Snoopy dance. It's great in theory, but I have yet to see evidence that it is a well thought out plan that will have successful execution.
Okay. And lastly, advice for parents and grandparents.
Get involved, stay involved. Take your kids to church, but don't just take them to church and expect the church to raise them, because the church, frankly, has failed miserably.
Yep.
The church has been complacent. And I am appalled at the church, but be there at the school boards, run for school board positions, get in the faces of the school systems, find out what curricula your children are being taught. And if you want good access to know what's going on, parentsonthelevel.com is a very dear friend of mine who has worked in the school systems for years and lays it out what's going on. Get in the faces of the school boards, of the school systems. And if you can't get any answers, get them out and homeschool them, because whatever financial constraints that you have now, it will be far worth having those financial constraints now and the financial impact now rather than having a child damaged for life. But get them into church, be involved in your church, be involved in your youth group. Build up the youth groups. Make good soldiers and good warriors for God out of your youth groups. Because if you don't mobilize your youth groups to target those vulnerable individuals at school, I promise you, nefarious forces and demons will.
Well, and something that I would add that everyone can do, no matter where you live, is to get the pornography out of the kids' sections of your libraries.
Absolutely.
All right. So we are out of time. Do you have a website you would like to share?
It is under development right now. It's called imageunshaken.com. So we kind of did it a little backwards. We developed a production company first, and then we figured, oh, gee, we probably need a website. So imageunshaken.com. It will be up and running fully by the 17th, and you'll be able to find all of this information there. You'll be able to donate to the 501c3, because we are going to be giving back to our communities and to our churches to help facilitate exactly what you just asked about, how parents can get involved. To that way we can equip parents, we can equip the communities, we can equip the churches. So yes, imageunshaken.com, and partner with us. You know, together with God, we can change the world.
There you go. Imageunshaken.com, online, coming to your computer soon.
Yes.
Also, check out David's website if you would. I think you'll enjoy it. It's ibelongamen.com. All of our regular viewers know it, but Dr. Melanie, check that out. That's it for today, folks. Please share the program. We are on Rumble also, as well as WCNTV.net. Have a great week. We'll see you next time, and God bless.